time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for August 3rd, 2019. Last week, we still weren't 100% certain who would win the Tour de France, and for the first time ever, a rider from Colombia did just that, Egan Bernal. At only 22 years old, he is also the youngest rider in the post-World War II era. Next up is the Vuelta. As always, it's 3 weeks. It'll span a total of 3,272.2 kilometers. There'll be lots of climbing. The race is going to begin with a flat time trial at the Gran Salida in Las Salinas de Torrevieja. I hope I said that right. It's a natural park with pink-hued water lagoons in the south of the province of Alicante and ends Sunday, September 15th in Madrid. Lots of options for following along online if you want to watch the race. So let's move on to this week's show. We're going to take a trip across the pond to talk with long-distance cyclist Andrew P. Sykes. Back in 2010, Andrew was a French teacher with a summer break ahead of him and decided to take a bike trip with Reggie, the name he gave his Ridgeback bicycle. That first trip and some encouragement he received from someone who was vicariously following along while awaiting the birth of her daughter by reading his blog each day has since turned into 3 trips, 3 books, a blog, a podcast, videos, speaking engagements, and we'll let him tell you more. He'll be with us in the second half of the show. My first guest, though, is John Stacks. He is the STEM and science liaison for the Specialized Foundation. Specialized Mike Sinyard founded the organization to bring cycling to middle school children, especially those suffering from ADHD. John, who comes from a science background, will fill us in on what current research is telling us about the effects that riding a bicycle have on children, especially those diagnosed with ADHD and other similar issues. These findings have come as no surprise to Mike Sinyard as he experienced the effects of ADHD pretty much his entire life and then saw them arise in his son, Anthony. Recently, the foundation has undergone a rebranding. It's now being called Outride.org, and John will tell us why and what the hopes are for the future. Hi, John. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Oh, gosh. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Well, you know, you send these emails out, and I look at them, and I'm really kind of excited because I've never actually been able to talk with anybody about the Specialized Foundation, and I do know about it, but I want to know more. I'd like to know a little bit about you and your involvement with the foundation.
Yeah, so I was recruited about better part of 2 years ago, and it was really around my passion for cycling. So I used to compete as a cyclist, and really that was so long ago. I haven't really given back as much as I would like. So that was part of the passion to bring me on to the team. But then the other part is I've got a life science background. And so that was a big part of this foundation, was strengthening the story with respect to science. And we can elaborate further on that, but that was basically the platform that I came onto the team with, and been just a great experience for me. I've learned you mentioned email. Yes, I've gotten really pretty good at my outreach efforts with email and LinkedIn and all kinds of other social platforms just to communicate the message of what we're bringing to the table here for cycling.
I know that Mike Sinyard, who is the founder of Specialized, has a really deep interest in children and cycling and some of the issues that some children have. specifically ADHD. And so I'm really kind of interested in the science, and I would like to talk about that. Tell us what the science tells us.
I guess since you brought up Mike Senior, one of the great segues for him is that, you know, really there was a cycling article, you all should look it up. It's in Bicycling, and it said, cycling is my Ritalin. What that meant back then was, for him, he felt better and more focused when he rode the bike. And we didn't have the innovations in science, I'll call it that, to connect those dots to explain why Mike's feeling translated to, you know, science and data. That's now changing. We've got next-gen sequencing where they can sequence and see different expression patterns on a genetic level with people that are exercising versus not exercising. There's brain mapping that's being done with a fine group of researchers out at Stanford. They can basically track electrostimulation activity with a cap, and they've seen that cycling at a certain heart rate, certain amount of time, and with a visual of, you know, basically scanning when you're riding at that speed, gives optimal stimulation that very few other exercises do. And so if you can imagine, I'll give an analogy. If you're in a crowded room with a lot of people networking, and then you remove yourself from that room and become single task focused, and it becomes easier because now you don't have all the distractions of all the people and the networking, cycling and the scanning part of it at speed is kind of like that. And of course, there's a physical exertion. So that's just, you know, a bit of the science. We're also getting into obesity. There are mental health issues associated with this. Mindfulness, you have to be mindful when you're on the bike. And we've noticed, especially with kids, there's a lot of anxiety with more information in social media that really is never put away. And so this gives a necessary break from that, and it also relieves the mind from that constant feeding of, I'll call it, bad or stressful information, and replacing it with just survival, exercise, and feeling good after you're done. And there are many chemicals released internally, you know, after you do the exercise. So that's a mouthful, but there's a lot of science to this, so just wanted to explain that.
Oh, and I appreciate that you're doing that. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with John Stacks. He is the STEM and Science Liaison for the Specialized Foundation, which has a new name, and we'll get to that in a little bit. So I think it's interesting. We can parallel a little bit of what you've said with Parkinson's, that we have a researcher here in Northeast Ohio who has done some remarkable things with cycling and Parkinson's, knowing how it changes the brain. That helps to reduce the tremors, and so they get better speech and better walking and better all kinds of things. So it's interesting that we're picking it up in children. I think it's awesome. So tell us a little bit about the overview of the foundation, what it's doing, and who it's reaching.
Well, that's a great question. I think that's expanding all the time because of the added story and strength of science behind it. But basically, I think it started with people that knew and identified with Specialized. So when we started, again, going back before I joined with Mike Sinyard, we really had a dependency on our brand with a Specialized name. And that was a really important step. But now I would say we're getting to a critical mass where the majority of the people that know Specialized probably know about the foundation. And this is now a time where we're shifting. That's the rebrand. And we're really looking to expand beyond just bike ridership. So we're looking at founding and funding partners, we'll call them that, that are really interested in STEM and want to donate to programs aligned to STEM. And as you can imagine, there's quite a lot of STEM with cycling, between engineering of frames, composition of materials, gear inches with math, exercise physiology and bike fit and nutrition. There's a whole bunch there that we can you know, capture and align data to as well. So we're expanding to those funding partners, but then also just, you know, a lot of people that want a great 501c3 nonprofit entity to donate to leave the world in a better place. This programming, which we haven't really touched on, but it is in middle school. So we're really focused on that age bracket because we think that the ability to adopt habits at that age is ideal because they have not yet learned to be dependent on driving from A to B. So we're really bridging to, you know, a lot of new audiences beyond the cycling and the specialized brand. Hope that answers your question.
Yes, it does. And I guess I'm asking how the programs work. Do they work in the schools?
There are three main areas to focus on with the programming. There's the research, and we talked a little bit about that, how this benefits on a scientific level the kids, strengthening why in ADD and ADHD it's helpful for kids, why kids who are in middle school have less obesity issues because they're adopting and embracing this program. And then also the executive functioning. We've seen that the standardized test scores have, you know, improved largely because these programs are in place. So that's one tier of it. But the other tier of it is, you know, just the Riding for Focus in-school cycling program, which gets more kids on bikes, right? And so that goes maybe more to your point around developing the habit for these kids. And as they grow up, they never lose sight of that habit. I also think since our urban areas are getting more full of people, it's a viable transportation source that a lot of the planning commissions are looking at because it's less expensive than urban, you know, mass transportation, subways or light rail or elevated rails. And, you know, often the infrastructure is not so encumbered that they can put in, you know, adequate bike lanes that fulfill transportation quotients for cycling as a means of transportation in these urban areas. So, you know, that I guess that's the biggest thing is you know, really getting kids used to that as a habit to ride the bike. And then as they become adults, they never lose that habit and they continue to do it. So that's feeding these, you know, new adoptees to the sport and the riding of bikes. Then the Outride Fund, that's the other pillar of the three pillars. You know, that's really about fundraising and all of the things I mentioned, the science, the research, the transportation, the impacting kids, the STEM, all gets, you know, baked into a message for making it very attractive for funding and partners who are eager to donate and leave this world in a much better place. And, you know, the better we're showing with the science, the research, and the outcomes, how this program helps, the more eager people are to donate to this. And, you know, again, it's not for profit. So it's all going into the programming and the scaling in the schools. We do have it in 130 schools and in 45 states and, you know, recently in Canada. I'll say one last thing. The two probably heaviest impacted school districts that we're in are LA Unified and in New York City in the Bronx. And I say that for the listeners because, you know, those are areas where you would argue it's the most challenging and difficult to get these programs in. But we've, you know, done that pretty easily with the programming and curriculum we have in place.
Let me remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with John Stacks. He is the STEM and Science Liaison for the Specialized Foundation and Outride.org. I want to know something about how the program works in the school. What happens if a kid doesn't have a bike?
Yeah, so there are basically a couple ways, and I should mention again for our listeners, if you want to learn more about this, what you want to do is you want to go on to www.outridebike.org. Again, www.outridebike.org, and there you will see just a whole bunch of information. On the homepage, it'll speak about how we fund, where we are funded, and how you can make contributions to this. Going to Diane's point, wonder if kids don't have bikes, we basically have a grant portal that goes live once per year. And basically schools that are interested submit, you know, basic level of information for their school or school district. That gets submitted to a grant review committee. And then that school falls into one of two camps. It'll either be a fully funded or a self-funded environment. And what that means is that there are criteria that the team uses to evaluate whether it should be fully funded or self-funded. And for kids that don't have bikes, we offer the ability to have one of our foundation bikes installed into that program. The beauty of it, either way that it goes, fully funded or self-funded, is that we really have to look at not just the upfront one-time cost. Those bikes typically last at least 10 years, so you can amortize the cost of seating a school, which is typically 30 bikes, $1,000 a bike. So that's $30,000, but amortized over 10 years, you know, because that's the typical lifespan of that bike. So you can really stretch your investment. You have to look at it that way, that it's not just a one-time upfront investment that is lost after the first year. You can stretch that due to the lifespan of the bike and how many kids are riding that. Those are all the outcomes that are really beneficial for a program like this and, you know, utilizing bikes the way that we do.
Do you know when the grant program portal opens?
Yeah, that opens in January, and then it closes in February. And people that have signed up on the website are going to receive updates. And, you know, they can also make sure that, again, you visit www.outridebike.org and navigate to the grant portal. And when you sign up for updates on that, that will get you looped in to all of the updates when the grant portal opens, because that may change, you know, but typically that's been about a 2 to 3 month window, and you can always submit it in early as well. We just advocate actively for, you know, the December to February timeframe of that grant portal.
So if we look long-term, John, what are the ultimate goals for the foundation?
Well, really, it's I would say to, you know, bring it into a prime time existence by getting anchor donors and repeatable donations on an aggregate level across not just the United States and North America, but I would say on a global level. And we want to mirror that with having this programming scaled, not just as it is now in the US and Canada, but we really would like to scale internationally, but we're a ways away from that. We also would like to get into all the states in the United States. And we have the ability to, we'll call it rinse and repeat or lift and shift programming right now, but we really want to scale to a larger footprint to all of the states and have just, you know, more riders going through the program and creating better habits in more places in the United States and all over the world. But that's the plan, is to get more funding to support that scaling.
So have any big donors signed on besides Specialized?
Well, right now we're in preliminary discussions, but we don't have anchor donors. So it's a great time to get involved because, you know, obviously, there's an opportunity to be one of those first ones. But basically, that was the whole reason and rationale for the rebrand of Outride, is to, you know, really move beyond Specialized as the anchor donor and move towards, you know, outside anchor donations and partners that really want to leave this world in better hands. And once they see what this programming can do, they believe they can do that. But as of right now, we're in just a lot of exciting discussions about that.
Well, once again, we've been talking with John Stacks. He is the STEM and Science Liaison for the Outride.org Foundation. You can find it at outridebike.org, and you can learn all about that and the grant program and how it works. I really appreciate you talking with me today. Good luck with the program, and thank you so much for getting in touch with me. I'm glad we got to talk.
Oh, gosh, my pleasure, and great touching base with you. And listeners, don't hesitate to reach out to me if I can help you in any way with what we're doing in the foundation. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Have a great afternoon.
All right. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
John Stacks is the STEM and science liaison for Outride.org. If you're interested in supporting the organization, learning more about the science, or applying for one of the school grants, you can log on to outridebike.org. So let's take a break, and when we come back, it's off to Northern England for a chat with Andrew P. Sykes. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Diane Jenks, and you're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. A couple of weeks ago, and maybe longer now that I think of it, I noticed a really interesting tweet on Twitter. That always sounds so weird to me. Anyway, it was posted by a gentleman by the name of Andrew P. Sykes, and when I clicked on his profile, I said to myself, "Self, this guy sounds like someone you want to interview." And I was right. Andrew is interesting, bright, and rides a bicycle all over Europe. Clearly, he's my kind of guest. Hello, Andrew. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
No, it's a pleasure. Thank you for calling me.
Yeah, well, you're in England, we're in the United States, and I can't wait to talk to you because you do similar things to what I'm doing, only it's like your show's on steroids compared to mine, I think.
Well, compared to yours, mine is a very young podcast, and it has recently taken a long break. I did do another one recently because I just invested in a brand new touring bike, and I dedicated the last podcast to the purchase of that bike and some of the issues that were connected to buying the new touring bike or investing, as I prefer to say.
Right. Yeah, and I want to talk about that. So tell us a little bit about your background first. I mean, we met on Twitter, so I don't really know you, but I'd like to know where you grew up, how you got into cycling, and then we're going to actually kind of dissect your work a little bit, because it's not just a podcast.
No, on the contrary, the podcast is really just a new incarnation of something that I've been doing really for the past 10 years. About 10 years ago, I decided that I needed to, I was a teacher at the time. I still am a teacher from time to time. But I had a long summer holiday, and I usually tried to make the most of it, going somewhere, traveling around Europe somewhere, not on a bicycle, but it could be on a train. It could be jumping in the car and going somewhere, but doing something which was a bit more adventurous than just doing something for a week. But for whatever reason, in 2018, I hadn't planned anything, and the school holidays of 2008, we're going back now 11 years, and for whatever reason, that particular year, I hadn't planned to do anything, and I ended up watching a lot of the Beijing Olympics on the TV, and one day I was sitting, it was a Sunday morning, and I was watching one of the first events taking place, which was the women's cycling road race. The weather was very, very bad. It was very wet, but they were cycling around the Great Wall of China near Beijing. And I just thought to myself how wonderful it would be, how adventurous, how exciting, how potentially life-changing it would be to go off and cycle somewhere a little bit adventurous. And that was the first time I'd really thought about doing something long distance on a bike. I'd been a cyclist all my life. I'd never not been a cyclist apart from when I couldn't ride because I didn't know how to ride. But ever since the age of probably 7, 8, 9, 10, I'd been a cyclist, and I'd always had a bicycle, but I'd never done any travelling. It had always been to go down the shops or to go to work or whatever. So I decided that in 2010, so 2 years later, to give myself time to prepare and get ready, I would cycle from where I was living at the time, which was in southern England, to see a friend who lives in, or who lived at the time, in southern Italy. So that's how it all started. And in 2010, that's exactly what I did. I headed off at the beginning of the summer holidays, once the school had closed, and I started pedaling as a very naive touring cyclist across Europe.
I'm sure. You know, I love when people just launch themselves into these adventures and find out, oh, you learn a whole lot, though, really fast, don't you?
Yeah, I'd been planning it for 2 years, but it was very much I did do a little bit of experimental cycle touring. I brought the bike up here to northern England where I grew up. And I did about 10 days of cycle touring, staying in youth hostels, because I had a few concerns. One of my main concerns was that I would be very lonely on a bike traveling by yourself. I thought this might be horrible. This might be something that, you know, drives me crazy over the course of a week, 10 days. And I took my bike up to near the Scottish border and cycled down something called the Pennine Cycleway. And actually, one of the nicest things about that experimental trip, that was in 2009, was that actually I was never lonely. People were intrinsically interested in what I was doing. People in the hostels would talk to me. People would talk to me in the street whenever I paused to look at my map. It certainly wasn't a concern at all that I was ever going to be lonely. And that was a real boost of confidence for when I did decide to head down to Italy the following summer.
Wow. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Andrew Sykes, and we're going to talk about Reggie. Who's Reggie? What's Reggie?
He's the bike. He's the bike that I bought. It's probably the most common question I'm asked is why did you give him a name and why did you call him Reggie? Well, I gave the bike a name because one of the things I did in preparation for the cycle trip in 2010 was to start writing a blog, the blog which has now turned into my website, which is cyclingeurope.org. And I thought it made far more sense. It was certainly a lot easier to talk about something with a name rather than just the bike or a bike or the Ridgeback or whatever type of bike it was. So I decided to give it a name. And at the time, I had no intention of writing any books. So it wasn't as if this name was ever going to get stuck on the front of a book or anything. So I decided to call the bike Reggie's for the simple reason that it sounded good. Reggie Ridgeback, which was the brand of bike. I subsequently did write 3 books about the bike, about traveling across Europe. And perhaps it raises a few eyebrows now, the title, but, you know.
It's interesting.
It is, and it might help. It might help with the sales. Who knows?
Who knows? Who knows? So, how do you plan your trips? So, you now have 3 books, which means 3 trips. You're in the process of planning for a 4th trip, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But what kind of preparations did you make for this trip? Because you did have a finite amount of time. You were going to go back to school in the fall.
Yeah, for the first 2 trips, I had a job to go back to. I had to go back in the classroom on the 1st of September. So whenever I set off, I always needed to make sure in the back of my mind that I was going to be back in Britain for the 1st of September. In terms of preparation, clearly there were things I needed to do, like, for example, the obvious things like buy a bike and get some panniers and buy a few maps. But there was an awful lot of time, perhaps not wasted, but a lot of time in procrastinating, discussing the minutiae of particular bits of handlebar or particular bits of kit, which at the end of the day weren't crucial to the trip itself, but actually made it far more interesting and far more fun. I didn't do much planning in terms of the exact route. I had a vague idea where I was going to be on the first few nights, and I knew where southern Italy was, and I knew that there were various points in between where I wanted to visit. But it was one of the best decisions I made not to plan in any kind of detail. And I've not done that since. And if anybody, as they frequently do, if anybody emails me saying they're intending cycling to southern Italy or along the Mediterranean or from Tarifa to Nordkap, and they say, how do I go about planning? And my first piece of advice to them is, well, go easy on the planning. Don't plan in too much detail, simply because if you do plan in too much detail, there's a real risk that you become a victim of your own planning. You become committed to doing certain things at certain times, perhaps certain accommodation on certain days. It is a big leap of faith, and it does take a certain amount of courage. Not that I'm the bravest person in the world, but it does take a certain amount of courage to not plan those details. But your life on the road will be far more enjoyable if you don't do any of that planning.
Yeah, I could see that. Now, did you carry your own food, or did you stop and did you sleep in hotels or motels or hostels, or did you camp?
My preferred means of accommodation has always been, and will always continue to be, until I'm not capable of actually lying horizontal on the floor, a tent. And I've always taken a tent with me. I think there are obvious advantages to camping. First and foremost, it's very, very cheap compared to staying in a hotel. But secondly, and probably more important than the first, is the fact that it's a great way to meet other people. When you go into a hotel, and occasionally I stay in a hotel because I'm in a miserable mood, or I'm just soaked to the skin because it's been raining for 3 days or whatever. Hotels are very confining. You don't tend to mix. And if you started talking to people in the hotel bar, then, well, certainly in Europe, you'd get all kinds of strange people coming in and talking to you. Whereas on a campsite, it is a done thing. You muck in together. You speak with the people who are nearby in the tent. There's no barriers. There are a few physical barriers between you and the person in the next tent. And it's a great way to meet people. And I have done so over the course of the last 10 years, met some wonderful people simply because they happened to be pitching their tent next to mine on the campsite.
Nice. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Andrew Sykes. We're speaking about some of his adventures. So this first trip in 2010 resulted in a book.
It did, but it was never the intention of writing a book. It was a means to an end. It was a way of filling the summer by doing something a little bit different. I'd set up the website, and when I did the trip, I was writing a little bit of text every evening and posting a few pictures. It's amazing how far technology has come in the past 10 years.
Yeah, really.
Today it's very, very easy to upload pictures and to write text on an app and then upload it to your website or wherever. Back in 2010, even 10 years ago, it was a bit of a pain to sometimes do it, and you didn't always have a signal, and the time that it took to upload a picture was a bit of a, you know, you had to be quite patient some days.
Right.
So I was doing this all the course of the trip. And I had a colleague who was she was pregnant at the time, and she subsequently gave birth to her daughter in September. So when I was cycling across Europe, she was actually in the latter stages of her pregnancy, and I'm sure she had lots of things that she could be doing, but one of the things that she made sure she did do to fill her time while she was in the latter stages of her pregnancy was to read my blog every day, and I think she became a bit addicted to it. And when I got back, after she'd had her daughter, I was chatting to her, and she said, Andrew, you really should turn that into a book. And I said, don't be daft. That's, you know, I'm a French teacher. I'm, for goodness sake, I don't write books. And I laughed it off, and I smiled and didn't write a book about it.
Yes, you did. Don't lie.
not immediately, but the following Easter, so this is Easter of 2011, as a department at the school where I was working, We went out for a meal, and Sally, the person who'd said this to me before, she said to me, Andrew, you really do have to write that book, because if you don't write it, you'll soon forget all the details about what happened. And I went home that evening, and I sat down, and I thought, well, I'll give it a go. And I gathered together all the bits and pieces that I generated, the text and the photographs from the trip itself. And I started to piece together a story. I started to retell the story, not just of the trip, but of the 2 years prior to the trip when I was planning and preparing the eventual cycle. I was very keen to not – everything was rewritten. I used very little of what I actually wrote at the time. I think it was very important for me to write everything looking back on reflecting upon things in a very light-hearted way. So everything was rewritten. It was a bit of a detective job, because I needed to find out, well, actually, where did I go? What did I do after that particular event? What did happen? What was that person's name? So it was a bit of a detective job piecing everything together. And again, I didn't have that many photographs. I don't know why, but compared to the number of photographs I now take, I didn't have that many photographs to look back on. But eventually, after about 3 or 4 months of work, I found myself having a book. And I thought, well, okay. I didn't really expect anybody to read it. at least I've written it. And at least I've made a record that in years to come I can come back to and reread myself. And, you know, who knows, I might find it quite interesting. I put that on Amazon, and much to my surprise and delight, it started selling well on Kindle, and there was a bit of momentum created. It started to sell not in the tens, not in the hundreds, but in the thousands.
Wow. That just answered a question that I was going to ask later.
What it did for me, it didn't make me rich.
No.
I wish it had done. But what it did do is give me the courage that actually – you know, perhaps there's some mileage in this. Perhaps I should think about doing another trip,
right,
where I intend writing a book from the outset. And I think that's exactly what I did for the second and the third rides. And I think that changed the nature of the journeys to a certain extent, because I was, instead of my main obsession being to get from A to B, My main obsession with the second and third rides was not just to get from A to B, but also to make sure that all the in-between bits, C, D, E, and F, were interesting as well.
Yeah. Let's real quick, the three titles are Crossing Europe on a Bike Called Reggie, Along the Med on a Bike Called Reggie, Spain to Norway on a Bike Called Reggie. And that's going to be the end of Reggie, which we'll talk about in a little moment. We're going to take a real short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Andrew some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
Okay, we're back. And if you're just joining me, I'm talking with Andrew Sykes. He's over in the UK in Northern England. And we just talked about the three books that he's published since 2010. So that means like every other year, pretty much, you've published a book?
The first book was published very shortly after I wrote it, really, in 2011, the summer, late summer of 2011. The second book was published in 2014,
okay,
which is the year after I did the journey along the Mediterranean. And then the most recent book was published in 2017. I think it's probably worth going back to the first trip before we talk about the trips 2 and 3, because there was one aspect of that first trip in 2010 which was not good at all, and that was the weather. The weather in Western Europe in 2010 was very, very wet and also very, very cold. And when I eventually arrived in Brindisi at the end of the trip, I said to myself, if ever I were to repeat something similar in the future, I would definitely choose a location, choose a route that almost guaranteed blue skies and sunshine. So after I'd written the book and after I decided to do another trip, I looked at the map. I looked at the Eurovelo routes in Europe, and I decided that the one that probably would guarantee blue skies and continuous sunshine was the one that follows the Mediterranean. So in 2013, I took the bike down to Athens, and I cycled from Kerpsunia, which is the, in effect, the southeastern corner of Europe, along the Mediterranean, mostly, all the way to Cape St. Vincent in Portugal, which is really the southwestern corner of the continent. So that was the second trip.
How was the weather?
The weather was, for that trip, I was actually praying for rain. It was, as you can imagine, extremely hot, and blue skies almost every single day of the journey. And I wrote a book about that. That was the second one along the Med. And when I looked at the map of Europe after having written that book, and I kind of thought, well, good things come in threes, and it seemed appropriate to have a trilogy of books about cycling across Europe. When I looked at the map of Europe, there was the bit in the north, which I'd really never explored either on or off a bike, and that was Scandinavia, northern Germany, Denmark, Sweden, Norway. And I thought, well, what trip could I do to which was a step up from the previous two trips, but would also involve exploring that northern part of Europe? So I decided to take the bike down to southern Spain, and I started a journey at Tarifa, which is the geographical southernmost point of Europe, and cycled all the way to Nordkap in northern Norway, which is the geographical northernmost point. And that was a journey of about 3.5-4 months, passing through 10 countries in the end. And I eventually arrived there on the last possible day to see the midnight sun at Nordkap. And that's exactly what I did. And it was a nice, fitting way to end the journey. And after that, I wrote the third book, Spain to Norway, which was published in 2017.
So when you wrote that book, did you no longer work as a teacher? Or were you done teaching for then?
I still work as a teacher. But
oh, you
what
do?
I'd done, I'd left my job at the end of 2014. December 2014, I quit my job. I was working as a French teacher in Oxfordshire, in southern England. I'm a languages teacher, but I only teach French, and I thought it would be a good opportunity to go to Spain and learn some Spanish. So I initially came back up to the north of England just to do a little bit of preparation, get the bike sorted, etc. And then during March of that year, March of 2015, I headed off down to Spain, and I spent the first 6 weeks of that particular period of traveling at a language school in Cadiz, a beautiful Andalusian city, learning some Spanish. So that's what I did to begin with. And it was once that was finished that I then started cycling all the way to Tarifa, sorry, all the way to Nordkap from Tarifa. But ultimately, it meant also that I didn't have a job to come back to. It meant that I didn't ultimately have a fixed point at which I had to be back in the UK, which was nice in the sense that I could, I suppose, have kept on cycling forever. But needless to say, I didn't have limitless resources, so I had to the journey had to come to an end at some point. And actually, because I was setting off just after Easter in 2015, I did, as I just mentioned, finish that trip in July, so actually well before the start of the next academic year. But it did give me a bit of time to make my way back to Britain, settle back in, find somewhere to live in the north of England, and I then started doing different forms of teaching, short-term work, cover teaching, supply teaching, I'm not sure what you call it in America, and that's really what I've been doing ever since.
So let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Andrew Sykes about his, it's actually a wonderful website. It's cyclingeurope.org. It's Cycling Travel Adventure Podcast. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on the podcast, but it's really, really good. You've sort of incorporated video and photography. You've got your podcast. You've got your blog. You've got your books. You've got your speaking engagements. And then the most recent thing I watched was about you getting a new bike. Why did you retire poor Reggie?
Yes, he has been retired. He still exists. He's living his retirement upstairs in my spare bedroom. One of the things when I bought the bike back in early 2010, a few months before I set off to cycle to southern Italy, I knew absolutely nothing about buying touring bikes. Everything I learned, I did so in a very short period of time, and it was mainly internet forums and reviews online. But in terms of my own personal experience, I really had nothing to call upon. I tweaked the bike a bit. I changed the handlebars. I added things. I took things away. I always thought in the back of my mind how wonderful it would be to have a touring bike that I actually designed and met my specifications, not because I changed everything, but simply because it was built that way in the first place. Now, after having cycled across Europe three times, I dare say the bike, Reggie, could have probably done another trip if I'd spent a little bit of money repairing him and making sure he had all the components he needed again. But actually, I think I'd come to the decision that if I wanted to continue this, I wanted to continue the long-distance cycling and the writing of the books and the blog, etc. I really wanted now to move to that level where I had a bicycle that actually was a bicycle that was made for my requirements. And buying a bespoke bicycle is not a cheap thing to do. You can spend a lot of money buying a new bike. And it took me probably many years to come to the decision that, yes, it was worth the investment. Because this is now part of my life. I now do spend a lot of my time writing for the website, cycling, doing the podcast, things like that. So for me, it is actually part of my working life. And I thought, yes, I'm going to buy this bike. And so earlier this year, I started looking seriously into buying a bike, and I decided to buy a custom-built Koga. It's called a Koga Signature World Traveler bike. And she, this is no longer a male bike, she is called Wanda, which seems an appropriate name for a touring bike. Wanda the World Traveler.
So I'm going to just interject something right here, and I really like hearing you say how you came to the decision to buy a custom bike. So anybody who listens to the show regularly or who knows me well knows that that's been my business for the last 40 years, is fitting, designing, and building custom bikes. So I totally get what it does to change the way you think about and feel about your riding. And so I'm sure Wanda is a large step up, as much as we respect Reggie, from Reggie.
Absolutely. I've had the new bike now for, well, about a month, 6 weeks.
Oh, that's all? It's brand new.
Yes. It's only,
a baby.
In the last few months. Yeah, she's a baby indeed, but she's a rather beautiful one.
Yeah.
And the bike, Wanda, has all the features, really, that I've looked and drooled over other cyclists having, things I've seen online, for example. It has hydraulic brakes, hydraulic disc brakes. It has a roll-off 14-speed hub. It has a Gates carbon drive. It has a front hub system, dynamo hub system. It has the ability to charge my mobile phone while I'm cycling. It has beautiful wide tires, which make it as comfortable as a Rolls Royce. It is a fantastic, not just a fantastic looking bike, but it's also a fantastic functioning bike. It just works the way I've always wanted my bike to work. It doesn't make any strange noises, not yet anyway. It just works perfectly, and long may that continue.
Do you have upright bars? Or downturn bars?
One of the things I changed on the Ridgeback Panorama 10 years ago, one of the first things I changed were the handlebars. I hadn't had a bicycle with drop handlebars since I was a kid. After a few weeks of cycling with the drop handlebars, I thought, no, I do not want to have to cycle with drop handlebars. I want an upright position. I want a variety of positions. So I actually changed the handlebars for the butterfly bars. And that meant I also had to change the gears. It also meant I had to change the brake levers. And that began to start to fiddle with the original butterfly bars. But with the Koga, actually, it wasn't for the particular frame that I chose them with, and with the disc brakes, it wasn't actually an option to have.
Oh, right.
Butterfly bar. And the reason being that the cables, when they come out of the brake levers, were just too close together. And I think that's the reason why they didn't offer it as an option. So I looked at some of the other options that they were offering, and there's a chap called Ali Denham. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's an Australian cyclist, and he's a brand ambassador for Koga. He's currently in South America, doing a very, very long cycle from Ushuaia up to northern Alaska. So he'll be coming to your part of the world quite soon. He's worked with Koga for quite a long time, I think. And he has, in conjunction with the designers at Koga, he came up with his own handlebars, which are a very flat bar with some little bits coming out of the top to give a variety of positions.
Do you have a picture of your new bike on your site?
The new bike, yeah, absolutely. If you go to the homepage and scroll down.
There she is, Wanda the World Traveler. Oh, she's beautiful.
there's a post from the 30th of June, which has some really beautiful pictures of her.
Oh, look at her. Isn't she pretty? Oh, yes, it's scrolling through them now. I see.
Yeah.
Lovely.
And those handlebars were the ones that I went for. They're very wide, but they give a very, very comfortable position on the bike. It is, after all, a Dutch bike, and the Dutch are famous for having or for cycling in very upright positions on their bicycles. And the Koga World Traveler is no different.
This bike is specifically going to be doing another adventure. And when are you leaving? You're going to do a Japanese adventure.
Well,
or are you?
I'd like to. The reason why I chose to do Japan is because it seems a nice in terms of size. The size of Japan allows you to cycle from the north to the south, or the south to the north, even in a reasonable amount of time, perhaps 2 months. So that was one reason for focusing on potentially Japan. The other thing, I was initially inspired to do my cycling by those cyclists at the Beijing Olympics in 2018, albeit via my television, when I was planning, or when I came up with the idea for that original ride. I thought it would be nice if I could go to the 2020 Olympics, or if my ride along the length of Japan could coincide with the Tokyo Olympics of 2020.
How cool is that?
So if that were to happen, that would be extremely exciting. But there are a few barriers in the way between now and next July, which is when the Olympics are taking place. Initially, I had two main problems. I didn't have the finances, and I didn't have the bike on which to do it. I now have the bike on which to do it, but ironically, by buying the bike, it's made the second one a bit more
problematic.
I've got 12 months between now and next July, so who knows? In the meantime, I'm going to be heading off this summer, just really on a few smaller trips. I'm heading to, staying in my own neck of the woods in Yorkshire, off for a small tour along the coast near to where I live. Next week, from, if anybody knows this part of the world, from Hull up to Middlesbrough along the coast of Yorkshire. And then in
at the end of August, I'm going to be taking the bike down to the Isle of Wight in the south of England, where I've been asked to do some cycling by the local tourist authority to write some articles for them. And then, and this will be the real test for the bike, I'm going to head off to northern Spain, to the hills of northern Spain, the mountains of northern Spain, and do some cycling there in northern Spain from Santander in the direction of Santiago, and then head south into Portugal. And that's the plan for later in this summer.
Well, I wish we could talk all afternoon, but unfortunately we cannot. So I wanted my listeners to find out how they can follow your work, where they can find your books, and how they can follow your trips.
Well, all the links can be found on the website, cyclingeurope.org, and all the details about all the books are on there. There's links to the podcast, links to the various short videos that I've made over the years, links to all the photography I've taken, and that's where they'll also be able to follow me in the future.
I always ask my fun guests three questions. Now, this should be interesting because you're not in the U.S. What's your favorite food?
Oh, my favorite food, I think it's a food that sustained me all the way through northern Norway. Norway is a very expensive place. But actually, if you're cycling on a bicycle and you're camping, which is what I did back in 2015, and you're buying relatively cheap food from the supermarket, it's not that expensive. And I managed to live off fresh pasta. And I would have to say my favorite food is fresh pasta.
And what music do you listen to when you have a chance to listen? I take it you do not listen to music on your bike.
No, I don't. I thoroughly enjoy listening to the sounds of everything else that's going on. I think the people who do listen to music, then they're kind of missing something. Anyway, I have very eclectic tastes in music, which is a bit of a cop-out answer. If I can tell you, the last music I downloaded to my iPhone was, and I heard this on the TV only a couple of weeks ago when they were celebrating the 50th anniversary of the moon landings. And it's I think they're British, but it's a band called Public Service Broadcasting. They have a wonderful album, which is all dedicated to space. I would recommend it.
Okay, that is eclectic. That's very eclectic. Well, this is probably a moot question because of all your traveling, but I take it you do not have any pets, or do you?
No, I don't have any pets whatsoever. However, my brother and his wife, they're currently in Australia visiting their new grandson, and I have been commissioned by them to look after their cats. So I temporarily have two cats to look after because I have to cycle to his house every morning in order to feed them.
Well, Andrew, this has just been delightful. Thank you so much for talking with me. We've been talking with Andrew Sykes. He has this comprehensive and crazy wonderful blog, cyclingeurope.org. You can find his books, his podcasts, his blog, his adventures, his upcoming travel, all kinds of stuff. It is one of the most comprehensive blogs I've ever seen. Enjoy Wanda, your new bike. And we will keep following you. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and it's been a pleasure. It's always nice to spread the word about how wonderful cycle touring can be.
That is so true. Thanks, Andrew. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Andrew Sykes' website, cyclingeurope.org, is chock full of great photos, blog entries, podcasts, and of course, synopses of his trips. If you are interested, you can log on, see information about his books, and pictures of Wanda. My thanks to Andrew and to John Stacks from Outride.org for chatting with me today. And my thanks to you for listening. Remember, you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page. Send us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without an E. You can also leave a comment on our website, OutspokenCyclist.com. Please remember to rate the podcast on your favorite app and spread the word. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe out there. And if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.